Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. As usual, I'm in Libertyville, Illinois. Really happy to be here talking about one of my favorite subjects, American Presbyterian history, but we're getting into the Southern branch. And to do that, we have a dear friend of the program and a dear friend in Christ, a brother in Christ. We're very happy to welcome to the back to the program, the Reverend Dr. C.N. Wilborn. Nick Wilborn is just about ready to be associate pastor officially January 1st at Covenant PCA in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. He served there as a senior pastor for many years. A little bit of a pastoral addition and transition as our brother and friend Sean Morris is also going to be transitioning to the senior role there. But welcome back, Nick. It's great to see you today. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Camden. Great to be here.
Yes, I think if I'm not mistaken, the last time you were on our program, it was a rather unusual, memorable panel discussion.
Yes, it was.
We were speaking about Alan Strange's book on the spirituality of the church, and Daryl Hart and Time and Klein were on. So that kicked off a rather interesting exchange, a fiery, animated exchange that then continued in the follow-up, I think, over at PresbyCast. So it's just you and me today, the calm ones, I think.
I think we should be able to stay on track.
I think so. But we are speaking about topics, not necessarily that are unrelated, maybe to sum up some of that conversation, but we are digging into American Presbyterian history with a figure of Jean Lafayette Girardot. Really excited to talk about John Girardot and his history. And there's so many intersections and touch points with his life that touch upon or intersect with important moments, figures, key institutions of American Presbyterianism, and even extending beyond, as he comes from a Huguenot background, a French Reformed background. I'm really looking forward to this. Been wanting to have Nick on the program for a long time to talk about Girardot, and we're finally getting to it and excited to do so today. But I'll keep a link, or I'll provide a link in the episode description to anyone who'd like to follow up and read a biographical sketch or little article over at the PCA Historical Center that Dr. Wilborn has written. And that's going to be the basis of at least my half of the portion of the conversation today. But let me ask you, Nick, first, how were you introduced to Girardot? And perhaps I'm not even Southernizing his name. I'm maybe speaking a bit too French, so you'll have to correct me and get me oriented correctly to the way he might have said it himself. But I'd love for you to just give us a bit of an introduction to the figure. But I'm more interested to begin with is in your own introduction to Girardot.
Yeah. Well, first, it is the Americanized version of that French name.
Yeah,
is the best I can figure based on correspondence and particularly interaction with some of his black slave members in his church he pastored in Charleston. The pronunciation took something like a J-E-E, so J-E-R-O, Giro, R-A-D-O, Girardot. And that's the way family members pronounce it today.
True. Got it.
All over the South. One of the most helpful little books when I first moved to South Carolina to teach at the seminary, Mel Duncan, who I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with Mel. He's a ruling elder at Second Presbyterian Church in Greenville, South Carolina, where Rick Phillips is senior pastor. Mm-hmm. He handed me a little book that was published by the South Carolina Historical Society, and it's called The Correct Mispronunciation of South Carolina Names and Places. And South Carolina is strewn through with French Huguenot names, very prominent American founders like Henry Laurens and such. So everywhere you go, you have French names, counties, street names, you name it. And it came in very helpful through the years when I would observe other people mispronouncing the street names and the way South Carolinians would respond to them, not always graciously. And I was always proud that Mel had shared that little book with me, so I at least sounded
Yeah.
like I knew what I was talking about.
It gave you a leg up.
That's right. How I came to Jerido is really pretty cool providence. I was at Westminster working on my PhD, and in one of the seminars I had, I drifted into a paper, writing a paper, researching, writing a paper on the doctrine of adoption, at the encouragement of my advisor, Claire Davis. And so as I researched that, I came across a volume by a fellow by the name of Robert Alexander Webb. It'd been
Oh, yeah.
published by Baker or Erdman's back, 1940s or 50s. It was posthumously published. It was never a completed book, which is the sad part of that story. But in reading on Webb, then Webb led me back to another American figure, and that was Jerido. Jerido had been his father-in-law for a
Yeah.
period of time before Webb's first wife died, Jerido's daughter. And I came across this little 93-page treatment of the doctrine of adoption, which can be found in his discussions of theological questions. So I'm working on that, and then so I'm aware of him from that. And in the course of working on that paper, I was sitting down in the lower level at the library at Westminster one day, and Sinclair Ferguson walked by. That was just before he left to go to St. George's. He'd been at Westminster full time for a period, and he was leaving to go back to Scotland. And he stopped and asked what I was doing, and I told him. He said, "Oh," and he said, "So what are you working on here?" And I told him I was looking at this volume by John Jerido. He said, "I think that may be the most important 19th century writing by an American Presbyterian."
Wow, not just on adoption, but period. Wow.
And I said, "Really?" He said, I'm very fond of it." And I'll tell you another story when we're not on a timer about that same conversation, which is one of my high spots with Dr. Ferguson. But so I tucked that away. Okay, this guy, I don't know who he is. At that point, I really didn't know anything except his dates. Born November 1825 and died June 1898. And he wrote this little thing. And so I become interested in adoption. I proposed to my committee a historical theological treatment of the doctrine of adoption. That was approved. I began working, and I get a tip that I may be late because someone at Edinburgh, it was just finishing such a treatment.
Yeah.
And so back in those days, in the late 90s, It wasn't as easy as sending an email.
Right.
And so I was able to make correspondence to a fellow who was there finishing his work, and his name was Tim Trumper. And Tim's graciously sent me his work, and I looked at it and I took it to a couple of my my committee members, and they said, probably want to do something else, since this is exactly what you were thinking you would do. And unless you want to take his thesis and argue against it, that would be suitable, but could you, would you? And I said, it looks like I think I better not.
It's a good thing you
Gerald
found
Hart.
out when you did, even though
Oh,
it
yeah.
would have been inconvenient.
Well, and I've wondered sometimes, and that answered my wonder. I had wondered before where here's a dissertation on the shelf. You've been in
Oh,
those
yeah.
shelves of dissertations,
Yeah.
and you'd go along, and you're in the old ATLA doing
Yeah.
the research, turning
Yeah.
the pages, looking at subject headings and author headings and scripture headings, and back when you actually had to sweat and have paper cuts to do the research, And I have an argument in favor of that still being a better method
Yeah. Slow
than what we
thinking.
do today.
More deliberate.
But anyway, I was talking to Daryl Hart, and he said, "Well, okay, before you just completely go off this thing, have you run across anyone in your research so far that hasn't had due treatment? Maybe no dissertations have been on his life and work. Sort of, my Machen. Is there somebody like that that you've come across?" And I said, he said, "It's worth looking. Go and look. That way, this has not been wasted time, and might be somebody that's in the adoption doctrine arena, but needs to have a treatment." So as I began to look, Gerardo became obvious, because at that point there'd never been a still no biography. Hopefully I'm going to remedy that next year, because I have a sabbatical coming, and that's my plan. And there had never been a dissertation. Now there is the life work that his son-in-law, one of his son-in-laws, George Andrew Blackburn, put together with a host of friends and former students writing chapters.
Think that's great.
And that has served as the only biographical resource for all these years. And it's a worthy treatment. It's just not really a biography per se, and certainly not what we'd call intellectual biography of sorts. And so I went back to the committee with a proposal after I talked with Daryl, and that I would do his life and his in his setting as an American Presbyterian. And that's how I came upon Gerardo, and then after that it just became even more exciting the more I learned about him. And he's a pretty remarkable figure.
It's amazing. I have a very nascent but analogous experience right now with Ned Stonehouse. And I'm doing some work on him, mostly editing his Presbyterian Guardian articles into a volume that we hope to publish with the OPC's Committee for the Historian. But there's something kind of magical. I'm using that in a, I guess, flexible, loose term here, not in any mystic, pagan sense, of course. But there's something about getting to know a figure, who's passed, but getting to know him through his works and correspondence and history. And there's something peculiarly rewarding and refreshing. It's hard to describe, but when you dig into someone, and rather than being disappointed, the more you learn and study, even when you find things that aren't the most pleasant, nevertheless, you see even maybe in their response or their work or the way that people thought about them, it's rewarding when you really appreciate them even more. You know, I was kind of worried, you know, if I have such admiration for somebody and I want to dig into their letters or dig into their notes or correspondence, what lies ahead? Perhaps only disappointment. You know, there's always that trope that you never want to meet your heroes because they can't possibly live up to what you think about them in your mind. But do you feel any of that? Again, for me, it's nascent and I can't, you know, I'm not prepared at all to write anything really thorough on Stonehouse, but what I have done so far, he seems to be such a figure. Did you feel that way with Giraudoux?
Oh yeah, certainly. And there are the skeletons. There are the dark sides. I mean, we're talking about, in his case, a 19th century figure, and a Southern man. Mm-hmm. And
his father owned a plantation too, right? So I mean,
he did. It was small. You know, it's not what we think of. You know, it's not Going with the Wind, Tara. You know, Tara or anything, but. It was your typical plantation in the U.S., not just the South. But he really comes off as very complicated. Mm-hmm. There is no, just to be blunt, there is no, well, he disliked black people. He thought they were subhuman and... That's the end of the story. Mm-hmm. He didn't dislike them. He didn't think they were less than Imago Dei. He did have some typical views concerning them that was shared not just in the South, but throughout the U.S., throughout the world at the time. And frankly, you still find in some regions today that while they might be image bearers and there might be some inferior superior relationships when compared to other cultures. Mm-hmm. And yet he differed greatly from, we'll just use Robert Dabney, his contemporary, who didn't think that the black men and women would ever achieve more than that status or could achieve more than that status in life. And even within the church, they would never be qualified enough to hold offices in the church. And Giraudoux disagreed with that.
Right.
And believed differently. So, yeah, you have those kind of things, but on the other hand, he was remarkable like so many. I'll use Dabney again. I mean, my goodness, you look at Robert Dabney and, you know, we talk about Renaissance men sometimes, and Dabney was certainly qualified for that. You know, he was an architect. When you go down to Virginia, you go to Hampden, Sydney. I don't know if you've ever been over to the university there, out in the middle of nowhere. You still can't get to Richmond from there. I two summers ago when we had our GA in Richmond, I went through there and spent a little time on the campus and just to reacquaint myself with some of that region. And it was still hard by car to get to Richmond. But you find, you know, there's a church house, a church building out there in the country that he designed and was the contractor and builder on while he was teaching at the seminary. You've got his home on the campus. You have the chapel on the campus of Hampden, Sydney that he designed and built. You go over to Fisherville, just off of I-81 and 64, and there's that beautiful Tinkling Spring Church, Presbyterian Church. He designed that and built that when he was the pastor there. Languages galore. Well, Jared was pretty much the same sort of man.
Wow.
And as far as academics is concerned, so there's it, it's there's a lot to be impressed with, and his certainly Dr. Gaffin asked me when I was sitting with the faculty to defend my dissertation. And they excused me. And as I got to the door, Dr. Gaffin said, "Oh, I forgot. I need to ask you a question. Could you come back?" I was like, "Oh, no." Dr. Gaffin, as you know, kind and generous and gentle man, and so intimidating. Not intentionally. He's not intentionally intimidating, but
No,
it's just
because of our
you
esteem
know
for
his
him. Yeah,
mind.
sure.
Yeah. And so I go back and I sit down and I'm like, "Oh boy, I thought I got away with this." And he said, "Simple question. Who's the better theologian, Dabney or Jared? And why?" Of course, at that time he was still requiring Dabney's lectures in his systematic class, at least some of the sections for collateral reading. And I said, "That's a tough question. For one reason, Jared never wrote a complete systematics. But I'm going to just go ahead and say, I believe, based on two or three factors, that Jared was." And he said, "Okay, why?" I said, "I believe that he had a more robust covenant theology, and that plays through everything he did. And I think that covenant theology also made his lectures that I've come across that students took notes on more practical at the end of the day." And so he thanked me, I left. And so that I think we've kind of run off the tracks
I don't
there,
think
but
so.
those are some of the reasons why Jared still enamors me, because I have his picture right here over my desk. Is the picture in 1874 when he was moderator of the PCUS General Assembly. And I catch myself, and I know I have some Scottish blood in me. And if I didn't know it, I would suspect it, because I have a little streak of mystic in me occasionally pops out. And sometimes I just stop in the course of studying
Look up
for
as you're
sermons or
Jared.
whatever, and I just look at Jared and I'm like, what would you do with this? How would you think about this?" And thankfully he's never answered, but I do find myself pausing and just wondering,
Yeah.
how would he preach this passage?
It's interesting about the Scottish connection. There's one thing in the biographical sketch that I was looking at and reading. Giraudoux's family was of French Huguenot descent. You mentioned how that's not uncommon in the Low Country there in South Carolina. Yet he had a very strong Presbyterian identity, not not English, but particularly Scottish, you know, and I'm curious and interested, how did his Huguenot and Scottish Presbyterian heritage and influences shape his faith and maybe eventually his understanding of ministry and his calling?
Yeah. And it's in the low country of South Carolina, the Presbyterian presence there dates back to early. The first Presbyterian church in that region is on Edisto Island. And yeah, they're not unlike a number of churches, old churches. They don't have their early minutes of session meetings and congregational meetings. You know, sometimes you get into these studies and you find, oh, yeah, we did, but the termites got them. More often, it's a fire. Mm-hmm. You know, lost. They were in the building. The building burned. They burned. Edisto, the Presbyterian Church of Edisto Islands, has that story. So the first several years of minutes are missing, but there's evidence that that congregation originated sometime in the 1680s, late 1680s, 89 maybe. And so that puts it in the same time frame, you know, with Francis McCamey, yeah, and his mid-colony work. And of course, we think of him as our father of American Presbyterianism. Yep. But that church was founded by Scots. And then in 1700, a fellow by the name of Archibald Stobo ends up in Charleston by way of what we call now Panama, because the Scots tried to colonize that area. And between the bugs and disease, they lasted almost 2 years.
No peat either.
And yeah, true. And the one ship that makes it back is in Charleston Harbor, and the history says a squall, a hurricane, destroyed it. He and his family were already in town, Stobo, preaching for the dissenter church. Stobo ends up founding at least 8 congregations in the greater Charleston area, and the first presbytery in 1722. That predates Samuel Davies' Virginia Hanover Presbytery by 30 years. And so often people say, you know, Hanover was the first Southern Presbytery, but actually you had this 1722 Presbytery in Charleston with 8 to 10 churches. And his Scottish connection, you've got Douglases, and you know, you got all these Scottish names coming into the Lowcountry pastoring these churches. And and they relate to Scotland, not to the mid-colonies. You don't really have any kind of real connection between those Lowcountry Presbyterians and the synods of the mid-colonies until really the First General Assembly, as they're beginning to work through those years building up to the First Assembly in 1789. So they pretty much run their own Scottish thing down there. And that's the environment Gerardo grows up in. And even though his pastor, beloved pastor, Aaron Leland, was English through New England, and influenced him greatly, probably the second most influential man was Thomas Smythe in the city at Second Presbyterian Church. And of course, Smythe has that strong connection to Scotland. He and Chalmers are friends. He and Cunningham are correspondents. And so Gerardo, when he's in college, well, even before he's in college, when he's in the, what we would call, they've been high school in the city, he was attending at Second Pres. And so during those years and the Second Pres or the college years, Smythe is his influence. And of course, he's hearing all about Chalmers
wow.
and all the Free Church men. And he gravitates quickly toward that Scottish simplicity over against the French Huguenot tendency. And most of the Huguenots by this time have gravitated to the Anglican church or Anglican churches in Charleston. Mm. And there's only, by that time, there are only two Huguenot churches left in the Lowcountry because they couldn't get French-speaking pastors to come. And their worship was more akin to the Anglican than to the Scottish Presbyterians. And so most of the Huguenots just kind of filtered into the Anglican church.
Wow.
Some Presbyterian, but not always.
Speaking of his abilities, you've already compared Gerardo to R.L. Dabney and indicated his abilities there. He graduated as a celebrated Greek and Latin scholar. You bring up this interesting quote and comparison, but even though he was a fine scholar of these original languages, yet he chose the relatively poor road of Presbyterian ministry. But you make clear to differentiate poor in financial terms and not necessarily in terms of his own ministerial abilities.
Yeah. In 1860, he's been preaching for 10 years, 11 years. We'll just go back to the education thing where that summary you just gave came from one of his classics professor, Hawksworth. And, who lamented because he couldn't get him to stay and teach at the College of Charleston. And, but remarkable, you know, I know you're familiar with this. Some listeners may not be, but you know, at that time, education, really was pretty special. You look at the requirements for at that time it was called Charleston College. It's now the College of Charleston. And you look at the entry qualifications, he had to already be proficient in Latin, Greek, in the sciences, in mathematics. He had to be able to translate Cicero at a competent level and read, of course, those authors. And we don't even graduate like that now,
right?
For the most part, you know. So he goes in already knowing these things. He learned it at a little field school, as they called them, over on James Island, where his father's farm was. And then in the city, when he came over to do his high school work, which he finished by the time he was 14. So he goes on to college and he graduates with what we would call today valedictorian honors when he was 17.
Oh my.
And so then you hop forward. He goes to seminary up in the mid state at Columbia Seminary. And while he's studying there, he gets to go over just a few blocks from the campus to First Presbyterian. At that time, it was the only Presbyterian church. B.M. Palmer was preaching there. And then two blocks away from that was the college South Carolina College, now the University of South Carolina. Thornwell was lecturing in metaphysics and ethics. And so the students would go over there for his lectures and for his chapel addresses. I'm just thinking about this the other day. He probably heard in their first iteration Thornwell's addresses that were given and later published, his discourses on truth. And so that's the kind of education environment that he had as a seminarian, and talks about it in some correspondence. So then he goes to be a pastor, and there's a couple of churches he pastors right out of seminary. He passes up a very affluent congregation in another state because right out of seminary, he wanted to go back to the Lowcountry because he already knew what his calling was. It was to minister to the slaves, or the poor and needy, as they often called them. He did that even while he was in seminary in Columbia. And so then in 1854, he leaves his church several miles south of Charleston and comes into the city to take over a mission work that was designed for the slaves in Charleston. And his preaching was so remarkable that it was common for him to be introduced by one particular person as the Spurgeon of America, the greatest preacher in the Southland. And so he was, when you take homiletics, I guess still today, I hope still today, you know, they remind young men that you're going to be preaching to a broad audience. You know, not everybody's going to have the same level of education, et cetera, et cetera. And Gerardo's context was very similar because the church, as it grew, had slaves, free blacks. Charleston had a large population of free black citizens. And of course, white people, and they were all over the board educational wise. Some would have been, you know, working in the stables in town, and others were the bankers and lawyers. And visitors would come in from the north, and they would all leave with the same testimony. A, this great sermon that placarded Christ before our eyes and our hearts, and B, everybody in that big room knew what he was talking about. Whether you were illiterate, poorly educated, or highly educated, everyone benefited.
Wow.
And no one ever felt like he was speaking over them or condescending to them. It must have been a remarkable thing to sit under the ministry of Gerardo.
And this is Zion Presbyterian Church, right? The name?
Yeah. It started as just a mission. In 1859, they outgrew the 500-seat building that they had built in 1850. And they moved into a building that seated over 1,500.
Wow.
And the practice at the time was for slaves to sit in what they called then a gallery. We call them balconies today. And when they built the building in 1850, it was one level so that everyone sat together on the same level. And that was purposeful. That was to make a social statement, actually. when they moved into what they named Zion on a very prominent corner in Charleston, they had to, for seating capacity, they had to have two levels. Mm-hmm. But what they did is they seated the slaves on the main level, and the free blacks and whites sat in the gallery. And again, that was a statement to the community that this is their church. They're not just stuck away somewhere in another area. And and he was preaching three services to over 1,500 people. Wow. during your typical Lord's Day. They were catechizing the slaves so well that he was often accused of teaching them to read, because people would hear them singing the hymns and psalms and reciting the catechism questions. And so they thought, surely, you know, they're violating the laws at the time on reading. But it was his way, and he was... This was constant. I'll give you an illustration afterwards, after the war, but this was a constant of his, and that was that whatever he had to do to rightly address the needs of his slave congregation, he would keep the spirit of God's law and maintain the civil law at the same time. And so while he expressed, along with his predecessor, John Adger, that they would want to teach them to read, and they thought they should be able to, they lived by the law of the land, but they also did this catechism thing so thoroughly that that they were accused of breaking the law, because they were educating them so well.
You mentioned the war, but was it not the case that after the war, some of the freedmen there at Zion Church specifically called for Giraudeau to return to Charleston as their pastor, rather than receive what might have been the other option, to receive a missionary from the north? What does that tell us about Giraudeau's relation to these brothers and sisters in Christ?
Yeah. So the war comes. Let's go back to the Zion. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that was Zion Presbyterian, and it was. When they moved in that new building, the session, it was an all-white session, largely out of Second Presbyterian Church, but some other churches as well that we're all now members there. It was there. They determined that, you know what, this is their church. We've told them it's their church. We built it for them. Mm. They get to sit on the main floor. They get to take communion first. Let's let them name the building, or the church. Let's let them name it. Now that we're moving from mission status to what we would say they particularized. And it was their choice to call their church Zion. And my wife would have warned me had I told her I was going to talk about this. There are some things that I have a hard time talking about in relation to this, because I find them rather emotional. Mm-hmm. But you just imagine that their experience since 1846, when this mission work had started under John Bailey Adger, and then the transition to Giraudeau, their experience had been so good and so sweet that the way they viewed their church was, this is where God is. Mm-hmm. This is where God meets with us, and we meet with him. This is about nothing else. And so they chose that name.
Wow.
Zion. And so the Warriors come. Interestingly, the membership sustained itself during those years. In fact, they added members out of the slave community and the free black community during the war. The elders that would have been in town held their minutes from that period. Jared O would occasionally be able to come back, and they would hold session meetings and do interviews for membership. And so 1865 comes. Jared O is returning. He makes it as far as the Florence, Darlington area of South Carolina, and his family is there because they've been locked out of their home in Charleston. And he receives a letter from seven or nine men that had served as watchmen in the church. What that meant was, before the war, because of their minority status, they didn't feel like they could place them as officers over the white part of the congregation. And we can argue with that, but that's just in that social context then, that was their thinking. But they gave them titles and they gave them a position, and it was largely elders that they were doing elder work. They had deacons as well that cared for different, they called them classes, and each one of them had responsibility for 50 people that they ministered to all around the city. And pretty much Chalmers Parish Ministry in Glasgow and then Edinburgh later. And so these men from Charleston write a letter, and it's one of the sweetest letters I think I've ever read. And they basically tell him that, hey, things have changed, and there's someone here that's causing problems. You read between the lines and you know what's going on. It's the Northern missionary that's been sent down by the Northern Church in conjunction with the U.S. government's Freedmen's Bureau. And there's a whole terrible confiscation of the building of Zion that takes place and takes almost about a year and a half for it to get worked out in the court system before they can go back into the building after the war. But nevertheless, these men write and say, it's our desire, after they say this, that we want you to know that our relationship with you is still in its bud. And you get this, the picture of the rosebud still, it hasn't burst open yet. It's still in that bud form, and we want you to be our pastor. And then they say something just absolutely remarkable in that sentence. We want you to return and be our pastor just as it was before. And you read that and you're like, no way it could be just as it was before. You're now freedmen. But they wanted that same community, that same communion of saints, and they wanted him as their pastor. And so he takes that, and General Assembly elects him to be the successor to Thornwell. Thornwell's died at the beginning of the war, and he says no, he's going back to Charleston to minister to these people and rebuild the church. And he did that from 65 till the end of 1874, when what we would call today segregation was forced into the
Yeah,
situation.
there's at least two
And
big situations there. 74 is the latter, but even in 69, he encouraged the nomination of seven freedmen as ruling elders there in Zion, not just to retain the kind of makeshift titles, but actually to make them properly and duly ordained and installed elders.
Yeah. And they were the first in the South, in the Southern Church. And one of my favorite passages is for this very reason, the best I can tell, one of the first sermons he preached when he got back into the city in 1865 was from this text. It's 2 Corinthians 5:4, "For we do not preach ourselves, but Christ Jesus is Lord, and ourselves as your slaves on account of Jesus." And, you know, that had to be a remarkable day. He's saying things have changed. You may no longer be slaves. In fact, you're not, but I am. I'm still the slave to Christ and to you that I was before the war. And this is my relationship to Christ and to you. No matter what your situation is, yours has changed. Mine is unchanged. And we also know that he preached a series of sermons on adoption to them before the war, which must have been a remarkable thing for slaves to hear, that they were adopted sons,
full heirs
and co-heirs with Christ. Giardo had to do something else, and I mentioned this a moment ago, sort of that recognizing that he would have to live with some tensions, even though he was a pretty strict constitutionalist when it comes to church governance and church doctrine. Before the war, we can't elect them as elders, social situation, but we're going to have them serve in that capacity anyway. The situation with the elders afterwards, he had recommended to the General Assembly in 1867, 66-67, that the church should recognize their majority status, as he called it, no longer a minority, no longer slaves, now free, and our relationship should be with them different, and that would include men who are qualified serving in the offices of the church. Had it not been for one man, I think, I can say pretty definitely, if it had not been for Dabney, that would have passed. But Dabney rose up, and it's one of the more embarrassing things Dabney ever wrote, was his response to Giardo's report. There's a lot in it that's just sad to read. Mm-hmm. Because Dabney was, yes, a man of his age and times, but there were other men who didn't react the same way Dabney did. So that makes it worse, in my opinion. So they don't get it through the assembly, but 2 years later, Giardo brings it, and he then, once the assembly passes that, yes, you know, we'll leave it to the sessions of churches to do this. The session in Charleston did see to the electing and the ordaining of these 9 men to serve as elders at Zion. And what they did, they knew that they're the opposition. They didn't want to put these men in positions that would cause more trouble. And so for those first years, they didn't attend as commissioners to generals or to presbytery meetings. But what they would do is in their session meetings, they would determine how the session would vote and act on certain issues that were coming up. And those men would cast their vote along with their white colleagues, and then the white representatives would vote their position. And that was twofold, was to keep them out of that situation of being perhaps mistreated at a presbytery meeting, or discounted, their position discounted. And so he was always aware that you may have to give up a few things to get to your ultimate goal and position, which I found years ago to be a very helpful little way about going about presbytery meetings and committee meetings, that sometimes you have to keep the greater good in mind and the future of winning at the big level, rather than just constantly losing back here at the starting line.
Moving a few years forward into 1874, he's at the General Assembly. You mentioned and alluded to earlier, this is when segregation really was imposed upon the church. How did Giraudeau respond to that? And what does this really, in many ways, this event really highlights him among Southern Presbyterians as a distinct and unique figure?
Yeah, let me say before, I mean, I've said this in print, and it is true. At that assembly, he was the moderator. He asked, in good parliamentary fashion, to for someone to take take the gavel, and he stepped down from moderating and moved to the floor of the church where they were holding the assembly, and he argued against what they called organic separation, what we would call segregation, of black churches and white churches. And he lost. Ended up being the only negative vote that's recorded in the minutes of that General Assembly. And I always say that that doesn't mean there weren't other Southern men that held his position.
He may have asked to have
like
his vote recorded.
You brothers in the OP. You brothers in the OP, rightly, as opposed to we in the PCA, have a delegated assembly, and they did as well. So not everyone was there, like so often is seemingly the case with our PCA assemblies. I know that men like Thomas Peck, who was Dabney's successor at Union and a South Carolinian, his position was that of Giraudeau's, that they shouldn't segregate, they should maintain an integrated church. And there were other men scattered all around the PCUS at the time like that, but they just didn't happen to be at that assembly to be able to vote with Giraudeau. But it does highlight his conviction that now I'll say, for full disclosure, there are some who've suggested that, well, he did that because he held a paternalistic view toward the black people, and he knew that the best way to keep them oppressed was to have them in your church with you. And I don't find and would challenge anyone to find any evidence. And when I have done that with historians, their answer is, well, that had to be the case, because that was how they viewed black people, particularly slaves. And to me, that's impugning motives, and that's doing some of the worst psychological history that you can imagine. Is, well, they had to believe that. Well, he never said that anywhere, and he never lived that way at any time in his life. Why you would pick that moment to say that is, but I always feel compelled to tell people that there is that version that gets thrown around sometimes that, well, the reason he voted was he really thought the best way to keep them oppressed was to keep them membership in your white church.
Giraudoux is a big figure, and not many people may know him. So, I mean, is in just in terms of just pure name recognition, as people are familiar with Dabney, as we've mentioned, and certainly James Henley Thornwell. Giraudoux was an editor of Thornwell's collected writings, but in that activity, but even beyond, how would you characterize Giraudoux's influence on Southern Presbyterianism in general?
Yeah. I think one example, a few things. I'll have to stop at some point, but in 1879 and 80, he wrote a series of articles on the office of deacon, almost 200 pages of articles on the diaconate. If you look back in the Book of Church Order at that time, both in the Southern Church and Northern Church, and if you come forward a few years even, you'll look at the office of deacon in the book, and it's like a little paragraph. Yeah. You've seen them. Yeah. It's largely, they're responsible to collect and to distribute funds. And you move forward a few years, and ultimately by the 1925 Book of Church Order in the Southern Church, that paragraph has expanded to about a page and a half. And it's pretty much identical from that point in our book in the PCA, and yours is very similar. I would suggest that Giraudoux's office of deacon, Giraudoux is where y'all got it too. Because I can't find any other, in studying it, I can't find any other trail to follow into your book except the old Southern book, which is okay. You know.
And Machen, of course, grew up PCUS. He would have been familiar with the book too. They're good reason to believe this may be the case. I'll have to set my army of research assistants upon this, Nick.
Yeah. That's certainly one area that he has a continuing influence on our churches, is in the office of the deacon. And then that spills over into the whole mercy emphasis that we have in both of our churches. The doctrine of adoption I mentioned, when I read Professor Murray on adoption, it's pretty evident that he's indebted to the 19th century in general in the development of the doctrine. From Scotland, that would have been Candlish and Crawford, Thomas Houston in Ireland. But in the States, there was Giraudoux, and then his son-in-law Webb, I mentioned earlier, and of course that volume, published, as I said, posthumously, but it's basically Giraudoux's work expanded. Unfortunately, Sinclair says, and at least told me, he thought it was one of the more disappointing books on the doctrine, because, you know, you may know the title is something like The Reformed Doctrine of Adoption. It's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty promising title. And yet, because he died before he finished it, it doesn't advance beyond Gerardo's 93 pages, mm-hmm. pretty much. So it is disappointing in that regard, but it was influential and would certainly have been read by Professor Murray along with all those other 19th century men.
Wow.
The one thing we've not talked about, I'll just say, is the battle in the Southern Church over evolution.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
I won't take but just a moment with sure. that because it's too big of a story. But there was a professor that they had added a chair at the seminary in 1860. Mm. For the relationship of science to the scriptures. Woodrow Wilson's uncle, James Woodrow, was the professor that was chosen from Georgia to come over and teach in that capacity. In the 1870s, Dabney realized there was a problem. And he took up the pen against Woodrow and some public writings of Woodrow's. And they had this little combative exchange in the 1870s, and then it kind of went dormant for a while. And then by 1881, 82, Gerardo is now, he's forced out of his pulpit in Charleston. He's now the professor. Politics in the church is one of the most unseemly things that you can imagine. Mm-hmm. You expect it out there, in October and November. We get it year round now.
Yeah.
But William Plummer, listeners will be familiar with Plummer. When Gerardo didn't come to the seminary after the war ended, Plummer took up Thornwell's mantle, sort of, and wrote a number of worthy things. He was the professor of didactic and polemical theology, as they called it then. Now the church has the opportunity to have the man they wanted, Thornwell's natural successor, Gerardo. And Gerardo did not know this was going to happen. At the assembly of 1874, after they voted on this
organic
separation, a motion comes to make the venerable Plummer the professor of pastoral theology. He had just published a book on pastoral theology. Made a lot of sense. It was like an English Parliament. Hear, hear. Everybody was on their feet, probably, and they pass it, and he's now the new professor of pastoral theology. And I don't even think Plummer knew what hit him, because the next thing was, now that we have vacated the chair of the systematic theology, I nominate Dr. Gerardo. And all of a sudden, Plummer's out and Gerardo's in. Gerardo refused it. But left the door open to be persuaded. They did. Committee was formed to accept his acceptance later on, and he took up teaching the next year and was the systematic theology professor there for 20 years.
Wow.
And in that capacity, and the seminary began having financial problems, and it was partly identified that the financial problems were because patrons were not happy with this evolutionary teaching that was taking place. And they went to Dr. Gerardo to be their spokesman. And so he did. At one point, 1886, they weren't able to get any traction. Woodrow was still on faculty, and Gerardo resigned, sort of a protest thing. It almost broke the seminary. He started a new church in Charleston through the Presbytery during that time that he was off. The next year, Woodrow was out and Giraudeau came back. And there's they were interesting little thing. Several years later, after Giraudeau had died, Woodrow's still living, and he was elected as the moderator of the synod and gave the moderator speech. And after it was over, and he defended himself in the evolution controversy as his speech. And for the first time in synod history, they voted not to publish
Really?
the moderator's speech.
Wow.
And so it was this thing went on for a long time. That's the reason I bring that up, is here you are 20 plus years later, Giraudeau's dead, and yet it's still going on
Goodness.
in the church. It dragged on for a long time and had some pretty negative effects.
I have a handful or a stack of some books here from the Reform Forum Library. We've got several volumes from Sprinkle Publications, Life and Sermons by Giraudeau, Calvinism and Evangelical Arminianism. Then another here, Discussions of Theological Questions. And I've also found the Will and Its Theological Relations, introduced by Richard Muller. This one's published by Reformation Heritage Books. This is a facsimile. I don't know. Are there other titles you might recommend? And among all the works that might be available to people, either in print or maybe on Google Books, now a lot of this stuff you can find just scans of it if you can't find other copies.
Yeah.
What would you suggest to people, perhaps other than his work on adoption or in addition?
Yeah. There's one that you didn't
Yeah.
mention that was probably
We need to get a copy of it then. We don't have one. This is what we have.
there's two that probably had the strongest reaction, peer reaction, upon publication. One was the theological, the Will and Its Theological
Yeah.
Relation that RHB has just redone, and Dr. Muller has written a grand introduction for it. Very helpful. It's worth the price of the book just to read his introduction. The other is his Music and Public Worship.
Oh,
And
sure.
that is an argument for not having musical or instrumental music in public worship is the title of the book, of not having he and there he's going with Calvin and his Scottish heritage. And Dabney wrote a long, in the 19th century, book reviews, if you look in the Princeton Biblical Repertory or
Sure.
any iteration after the review,
Yeah.
book reviews were an opportunity to write your own article on the topic,
Right.
right?
Yeah.
Purportedly, I'm about to review this book, and you don't read long into those lengthy reviews till
Yeah.
you figured out this is just he just wanted to write on this topic, and
Right.
this is his
Occasion.
jumping off point.
Yeah.
Dabney did a similar thing with that book and wrote a very a robust defense of Giraudeau's position and more. But generally, already that was a lost cause in the Southern Church, the instrumental music thing. Giraudeau referred to, not in that book, but in a letter, referred to the organ as the great white idol. And if anyone's ever been in a situation where they were trying to get, doesn't matter if it's images of Christ or anything removed after a period of time in a
Yeah.
building,
Good luck
if you
getting the
don't
organ
believe we
going.
have idols,
Yeah.
he may have had, I think he had a good point. But anyway, the reason the will and theological relations was so controversial was because in that book, Gerardo, and this is a long time coming, he'd been working on this thing for right at 30 years from the first inception of his thinking about it and talking to Thornwell about the topic. So it wasn't a quick position he came to. But he takes issue with Jonathan Edwards' deterministic position on Adam. Could Adam have kept the probationary, the conditions of the covenant of works? And as you know, Edwards' position was he could only sin. That was decreed, and so that's what Adam had to do. Gerardo's position was then that makes the covenant of works not a true covenant. And I believe that Adam, Gerardo's argument, could have kept the covenant. Therefore, he would have been confirmed in righteousness. He would have been confirmed in his adoption. And we go forward from there rather than living in this indefectible state of possible failure all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time already, when it was published, there was already something of what I call a cult of President Edwards. And that's peculiar to me because, as I'm sure you know, as early as Archibald Alexander, some serious concerns and questions were being raised about Edwards and a number of his positions. Dabney takes on Edwards on a number of points. And this is one very similar to what Gerardo's dealing with book length-wise. Charles Hodge takes issue with a number of Edwards' positions on everything from the virtues question to A.A. Hodge, of course, takes several shots at his Edwards' governmental atonement theory. So all of a sudden, though, by the late 19th century, Edwards is becoming something of a favored figure. And of course, we come in the 20th century when the Yale edition of Edwards is published. All of a sudden, then from Perry Miller forward, you start getting, it's almost like the hagiographizing of Edwards until more recently. And now we're starting to see some people, you know, reconsider Edwards at some levels. And Muller, of course, is one of those. And that's why I think, having talked with him, he found this book to be a useful volume in showing that there Edwards may have not been as good a carrier of the Reformation and post-Reformation doctrines as some people had thought.
Sure.
So I think that's one of Gerardo's until recently relatively unknown contributions, because a lot of people were afraid to touch it for many years because, you know, you've laid your hands on Edwards.
Yeah.
And
the untouchable. My goodness.
Yeah.
Gerardo, what a great figure. Nick, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. We can keep going. We're looking forward to perhaps an extended treatment and Thankful for the fruit of your work already and for this conversation, but looking forward to diving in further. I really appreciate the time you've spent with me and with all of the viewers and listeners. Here you go. And looking forward. What do you have there? I can't make it out quite. Oh,
yeah. You know, I started this by saying that
federal theology
early on with Dr. Gaffin and his covenant theology. And a few years back, Ligon Duncan and Duncan Rankin pulled this little thing out of a collected writings. They did a memorial for one of the professors at Columbia in 1882. And Gerardo was asked to give an address, and his address was called The Federal Theology, Its Import and Its Regulative Influence. And I know that you can go on the Log College site, and it's available there. They had it published in a little paperback.
Nice.
That I got a hold of several years ago. And it's in there that you really get so much. There's so much we didn't talk about. His indebtedness to Owen and to Thomas Boston, particularly. He's a real Boston guy. And it really comes, the Boston side of Gerardo comes out real clearly in this little volume on covenant or federal theology.
Tremendous. We'll have to track some of those.
Sorry
down.
To delay our ending, but
I have nothing
Let
scheduled.
Us get away.
So I'm very thankful for the opportunity. It's always a joy and a pleasure to speak with you. We'll have to have a follow up, and hopefully we'll get some feedback from our listeners and viewers. And if we got any questions, we'll certainly round them up. But Dr. Wilborn, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time this afternoon,
Kevin.
And wish you the best and prayers upon you and your family and your ministry. But thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you. You too. Have a great Christmas.
You bet. And we'll take a look at everything. We'll have this up available soon. If everyone does have some questions or comments, you can head over to reformedforum.org. But I encourage you to visit our newer website, reformedacademy.org. We've had free online video courses for quite some time. We have more than 30 of them on all different theological topics and at all different academic or, academic levels. But now those have been organized on a new learning management platform. Everyone can find that at reformedacademy.org. And the reason I mention that, not only so that I hope you would take some courses, but that people would sign up, and there's a little community feature in there. So if you have any questions or comments, or you want to discuss today's episode, the topics therein, you can do so at reformedacademy.org. I want to thank everybody for watching and listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.